Golden Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today, we leave it to our London columnist to comment at the end of his programme on the event of the week in Britain, the birth of a princess. We take you first to the River Clyde to meet the world's first jet-propelled passenger vessel. We look in on the Festival of the Narrow Boats of Britain, and we bring you the voice of world statesman Winston Churchill. First, Mr. Churchill. While war rages in Korea, many thousands of miles away from Europe, Strasbourg just now is the scene of vital meeting between Europe's free nations, alive to the potential dangers that beset them, and anxious that if in Europe too, aggression with weapons should follow aggression with words, free Europe shall be ready to meet it. Mr. Winston Churchill's demand for a European army now has already leapt into the world's headlines. The precariousness of world peace lends added moment to his trenchant words to the Strasbourg meeting of the Council of Europe.
Great Britain and the United States must send large forces to the continent. France must revive again her famous army. We welcome our Italian comrades. All, Greece, Turkey, Holland and Belgium, Luxembourg, the Scandinavian states, all must bear their share and do their best. Courage and unity must inspire us and direct the mighty energies at the disposal of our government to solid and adequate measures of defense. Those who serve supreme causes must not consider what they could get, but what they can give. Let that, sir, be our rivalry in these years that lie before us. Now, the question which challenges us, Mr. President, is, shall we have the time? Sir, no one can answer that question for certain. But to assume that we were too late would be the very madness of despair. We are still under the shield of the atomic bomb possessed in formidable quantities by the United States alone.
But let's move now to the peaceful application of the war-spurred discoveries of science. Not the split atom this time, but the jet engine. And right now, in the Firth of Clyde, they're busy on experiments to discover more about the resistance of a ship's hull as it moves through water. Hydrodynamics, it might be called, and the tests are being made in the first ever jet-propelled ship, the Lucy Ashton, an old converted paddle steamer. She's been fitted with jet engines because any form of underwater propulsion, such as screws or paddles, would set up their own water disturbances and destroy the accuracy of the test. To the Clyde, then, for a report from our nautical reporter on the spot, James Buffon.
Well, that's the sound of that grand old lady of the Clyde, Lucy Ashton, just beginning to move through the water under jet power for the first time. She's been saved from the shipbreakers for the time being to have the time of her life at the age of 52, roaring about the Firth, powered by four jet engines, which give her a thrust of 5 tons, something over 5,000 horsepower. From here, she looks just like a miniature black aircraft carrier, for her funnel's been taken away and the superstructure. And instead, she's got a thing which looks rather like a railway signal gantry built across her just about midships and protruding out each side. It takes the four engines, two to port and two to starboard. We're not allowed to go aboard her just yet until she's had her maneuverability tests, and it's proved that she's quite safe. So we're lying off here in a tender, and she's just coming up to pass us now, putting on a bit of speed. The four jets are blowing back on the water and whipping great grooves out of it, rather like four giant mouths blowing too hard on a huge saucer of tea. And the mechanics, as she comes alongside, are wearing big white earphones to protect them from the noise. Aboard, it must be deafening. We're about 100 yards away. Listen. There's quite a wind blowing and a choppy sea, and she's just put the girder supporting the gantry on the starboard side right down into a wave, and the spray is flying clean over the top of her. I'm not sure that she didn't put an engine in as well, but we'll find out about that when we go aboard.
Propulsion may suit the wide rivers and open sea, perhaps, but
it's very unlikely that it'll invade the placid meanderings of England's vast network of canals, thoroughfares of trade as old as our very roads. Now, at Market Harbour, in the very middle of England, a festival meeting for our inland shipping, the first of its kind ever, and organised by the Inland Waterways Association, expressly to draw public attention to the need for keeping our canals alive and flourishing, their waters free from weeds and clogged only with trade. Traditionally, our canal craft are ornate in carvings and brasswork and painting. They're the gay and gaudy homes for hundreds of families who could never bring themselves to live on dry land. So, a festival with trophies and prizes for all types of craft, all converging for this gala week on Market Harbour, where they were awaited by our observer, Frank Buckley.
Brilliant sun and the blue and white flag of the Inland Waterways Association, some 50 craft of the 160 expected to arrive during this week are already lined up for the Association's first annual rally along the ancient 6-mile branch of the Grand Union Canal between Market Harbour and Foxton Lock. Already under the sunlit elms and among the lily pads, there are little ships from north, south, east and west of all varieties, from folding canoes to Norfolk duck punts, and from cabin cruisers to narrow boats, which the layman would call barges, 70 feet long by 7 wide. Barges, which are 14 feet wide, could never reach Market Harbour because of the locks. But the narrow boats convert into commodious dwellings. Through the window of one I saw, for instance, amid the traditionally painted water cans and dippers, a lace pillow and a cluster of bobbins, worked by an amateur barge woman in a brass-studded belt. Farther up the barge basin was the narrow boat of Peter Scott, painter of wildfowl and vice president of this association, whose object is to preserve and rehabilitate the waterways of England. Near him blazed the flagship of the harbour master, dressed overall. His ship was the Tosca, but instead of Scarpia, his name was Arthur Thornley of Leicester, and a very busy man indeed. Near him again was the imposing Kingfisher, official narrow boat of Sir Reginald Hill, of the Docks and Inland Waterways Executive, and a little down the line from that was a cabin cruiser, with everything on it but radar, nuzzling a duck punt in which a naval commander, retired, had done the 130 miles by water from Wisbeach. He was a grizzled and a bearded man who explained with heat that he was a sailing man by choice, that he'd installed a motor for this occasion only, and that after his experience with its innards, he was back to wind and muscle for the rest of his natural life.
The postscript from our guest London columnist touches on the event of the week in Britain, because princesses are not born every day. And just what it means for us is something that MacDonald Hastings can tell you. Mac.
The most exciting news this week for the whole of the British Empire is the news that Princess Elizabeth has been safely delivered of a baby girl. I can understand a citizen of a republic saying, what's all the fuss about? What does it matter? But in this troubled generation that we live in which all sorts of values are changing and all manners of hard-won liberties are in danger, it happens that the line of succession of the British royal family is a matter of vital importance not only to the British Commonwealth of Nations, but to the free world. This new princess, God bless her, is now, in the event of anything happening to Prince Charles, heir to the sovereignty of this realm, this England, this Commonwealth of Free Peoples. Only a baby, yes, and I'm sure an enchanting one. But a baby who is also a symbol of the British Constitution, something as sacred as Magna Carta and as representative of our way of life as parliamentary government. I very much doubt if the Londoners who've been crowding round Princess Elizabeth's home these past few days, waiting for news of the birth of the royal baby, could tell you as coherently as I can why they take such a personal interest in the goings-on at Clarence House. If you'd asked them, the crowds of simple people picnicking on the pavements, watching the comings and goings at the palace, they'd probably have been unable to explain why they behaved as they did. But deep down inside, what they felt was that Princess Elizabeth's new baby was Britain's baby, their baby. And whether able to express themselves or not, they're right. And that's the importance of this royal event this week. We in the British Empire welcome a newcomer to the inheritance of 1,000 years of royal history. In private life, Prince Philip and his wife are rejoicing, I know, in the coming of a baby girl to the family. In his private circle, Prince Philip's friends have been teasing him, as every prospective father is teased, about the addition to his responsibilities. Curiously enough, Prince Philip came home from Malta on his annual leave from the Navy, not only to be with his wife as the new baby was born, but also as a naval officer to take over his first separate command of a warship. He has been appointed as lieutenant commander to the destroyer HMS Magpie. And Prince Philip's friends didn't miss the chance to present him with the drawing of a magpie carrying stork fashion a bundle in his beak. But that intimate anecdote is incidental to a great national and royal event. Not just the birth of another baby, but a child on whose shoulders, well, who can guess what vital matters may rest. Shakespeare, who always has a quotation for it, has one, I think, for this occasion too. This royal infant, heaven still move about her, though in her cradle yet now promises upon this land 1,000,000 blessings, which time shall bring to rightness. Goodbye.
Thank you, Mac. And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.